Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got former Lancaster pilot Rusty Warman talking about his wartime exploits.
I remember coming up to see you a year or so ago, maybe a year and a half ago. I had just the brilliant morning. I mean, and I was lucky because I had about 4 hours rather than 45 minutes plus questions. And we had a great conversation. Just tell me, first of all, tell everyone a little bit about where you were born and brought up and how you almost never got to be a pilot.
Well, I was born up in County Durham in a little village called Shotley Bridge. I don't suppose anybody's really heard of it much. It's quite near Consett in the mining area. And my dad, who'd been in the Navy since 1905, he was a handyman on the Corry owner's estate, and that's where I started to grow up. But I was very, very sickly there. I had diphtheria. My mother nursed me at home with diphtheria, typhoid, chickenpox, all the kids' illness. And later on, when we moved into Newcastle, it's like up there, we lived in Newcastle in Grey Street, which is just up the road from the River Tyne. And I got TB, had a TB bowel. And I was in a wheelchair when I was 12. But when the war came along, at the age of 18, everybody was called up and could be directed into any of the services. Can you hear me all right at the back, by the way? Yeah, you could be directed into any of the services. And I was in a pupil severe, which nearly meant you'd be going into one of the engineering corps in the army. I didn't fancy that. You could even be sent down the mine to become a Bevan boy. Didn't fancy that either. So I told Mum and Dad, when I was 17, you could volunteer and have some sort of choice of which service you went into. So I said, Mum and Dad, I'm going to join the Navy, follow my dad's history, follow my dad's experience in the Navy. As a leading seaman, he got a DSM as a leading seaman. It's quite unusual. So anyway, they said, well, yeah, go on. He said, you're going to join up. He said, you'll never get in with your medical history. So off I went to the local school to join up. And in the classroom where I went to go in to join the Navy, with the naval recruiting officer, it was my own doctor, Dr. Wright. So I thought, if I go in there, I'll never get in. So I went next door and joined the Air Force. and my poor old mum, she wet buckets because my brother was already in the army in the Northumberland Fusiliers. So anyway, there we are. I was being accepted to join the Air Force.
And, so how did you get on in the medical?
Amazing. Well, the service medical was very, very thorough. I had a heart murmur. I was covered in psoriasis. Had varicocele vein, and how the hell I ever got in the Air Force, I don't know. But anyway, I was accepted to train as air crew. You didn't know what part of air crew you're going to be. They had a scheme called PNB, Pilot, Navigator, and Bomber. So if you didn't qualify as one, you went joined one or the other. So I went up to Manchester, to Heaton Park in Manchester, where we were sworn in. Well, we didn't get the Queen's shilling. We had to swear on the Bible that we were going to serve the Queen. The King was the King in those days. And then from there, we went down to London to a place called ACRC, Aircrew Reception Centre, which was at the zoo, just round the zoo. And there, we did all our exams and testing, attestation, which were mainly in the Lord's cricket ground up in the long room. So I've been to Lords and in the cricket room, long room with Lords. And much to my surprise, they said, you can train as a pilot.
Do you know why that was?
No idea. I haven't got the faggot. I think the only thing I can think of, they must have been very hard up for pilots. that they said, yes, you can train as a pilot.
Were you pleased about that?
I was amazed, yes. Oh, yes, I was very pleased because... We didn't, as I was, 19-year-old, I was 18-year-old then when I first went down there, so naive. Because of my health, I had very little education. I didn't do any school cert or matriculation. I didn't have any exams. So the only thing I can think of, I was a pupil severe, where we did a lot of vectoring on the drawings. And that's very similar to navigation in the air. So whether that had any effect, I don't know. But there I was accepted to train as a pilot. But there we had to start to learn about the Air Force. So I was sent down to Newquay, which is called an ITW, Initial Training Wing. And we went through there, square bashing, learning about the Air Force and that sort of thing. And from there on, we got our flying kit and I was posted to South Africa. So we went up to West East Kirby in Manchester, near Liverpool, and we were in the waiting to get a draft to go out in a boat down to South Africa. And everybody disappeared. In our room, there were 11 W's left behind. So we were there, we lived on the Nuffy for a week until the WAFs came in. All the WAFs came in. He took all the men off the camp and sent the WAFs in. And the WAF officer wasn't very pleased to see these 11 airmen there. So we were sent down to Brighton on the B course, which is the bad boys course. And we were up at 6 o'clock in the morning, running up and down the Corniche and booking in and booking out. And we didn't like this idea at all. It's not it. So we complained to the orderly officer, and he wouldn't do anything about it. So we wrote a letter to the station commander saying what our situation was. And he called us all into his office and said, "This constitutes mutiny. Court martial." When we tried to explain, he accepted what our explanation was. And of course, all our records had gone and all our kit had gone over to South Africa. So we had to start again. So we started another initial training, ITW, at Stratford-on-Avon. So that was quite an experience. I now live 3 or 4 miles from Stratford, and it's marvelous to see the statues there, which we painted the faces red, and we're just as naughty as nowadays. So, but that was fine. But before you went to learn to fly overseas, they had what they call the Empire Training Scheme. You had to prove yourself. So I was sent to an aerodrome at Wolverhampton, Codsall, which was a private aerodrome, and to fly Tiger Moth. And as soon as I'd gone solo in the Tiger Moth, after about 10, 12 hours, you finished about flying, and we were posted on this Empire Training Scheme to Canada. So we went out to Canada to... went across on the Polish boat, which it hadn't been converted for troops, so we had a very comfortable journey over there.
No trouble with U-boats?
No, we went direct. We weren't in convoy, so we didn't have, but coming back we did. But when we got there at St. John's, we went down to a place called Moncton, in British Columbia, in Nova Scotia, and that was a holding unit. And from there, we were posted out to an aerodrome just south of Calgary called De Winton. And this was way out in the sticks, out in the prairies. And this was, that's where we started to fly. We started to learn to fly on Tiger Moth, a little Tiger Moth, but the Americans at Boeing's very kindly sent 300 Stearman aircraft up for us to learn to fly on. So I did most of my learning to fly on the Stearman. And there I was, I'm a very slow learner. And there my instructor, who's an ex-Battle of Britain pilot, he said, "I think you better have a washout check to see if you're fit to carry on." So there we are, I had a washout check, and he said, it went off all right. And he said, "Do you want to carry on?" I said, "Oh, yes, please." So there we are, I carried on. And after that, I never looked back. And it like riding a bicycle, you know.
Was it just that something just suddenly clicked, do you think?
I think it was, you know. It was so natural, and I loved the flying. It really was lying. And the flying out there was nice, because there's no war, there's no rationing, there's no blackout, there's no air raids. And the Canadian hospitality was wonderful. They really were very, very kind. I had my first girlfriend out there, which was rather nice. But her mum and dad were very, very strict. Well, I was 18, I was coming up 19, and she was 17. And Dorothy, after we left there, we kept in touch for many, many years afterwards, even after both of us were married. So that was very nice. But the hospitality really was wonderful. And having passed out at the initial training, ITW and EFTS, elementary flying, for some unknown reason, I don't know why, at the end of the course, they said, what do you want to join, bomber command or fighter command? Well, you can imagine what 99% of us said, you know, fighter command. So I was posted to bomber command. And from there, we went down onto the prairies to Medicine Hat and Moose Jaw to fly the Airspeed Oxford. And that was great.
So you knew at this point that was it, that you were never going to be a fighter pilot?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. If you were going to be a fighter pilot, you were posted to a different unit flying the Harvard. The American Harvard. So we were flying the Airspeed Oxford, the twin-engine Airspeed Oxford. Nice aeroplane. We did all sorts of exercises there. Just as when we were flying on across country, there was no navigator. You had one was a pilot and one was a navigator. And halfway around, you switched over all the way back. And we were flying over the lakes in Canada on one across country with my friend, who's the other pilot. And he said, "Ooh, look at that lake down there, isn't it lovely? Let's low fly over the lake," which is strictly forbidden. So we flew down over this lake, and a flock of ducks rose up, and we clattered through this row of ducks, broke the windscreen, had a duck wrapped around my face, went ducking over. So when we got back, we managed to get back all right, and we were in a bit of trouble when we got back. But the fact that we got back helped us enormously, so we were allowed to carry on. And the next day at the mess, I had to go and see the dentist, and he said, "Oh, you flew that aircraft when it had the crash." I said, "Yes." He said, "We had duck for dinner last night." We got six ducks out of the engines. So that was a wonderful experience. And funnily enough, that experience helped enormously during the war. So there we are. We passed out from there. At the age of 19, we were presented with our wings. We took a white flash out of our cap and sewed our wings on. And you're a pilot.
Well, then, that must have been a proud moment, wasn't it?
It was quite a proud moment. But you were just flying an aeroplane. You didn't really know anything about what you're going to do with the aeroplane. You did all sorts of exercises, but nothing like war experience. And then, of course, we had to come back. So
didn't no one warn you about what it's like flying through flak or
no.
How to take evasive action?
No, just as well.
Yeah. Amazing.
We were terribly naive. I was 19-year-old with a very sheltered, educated, very sheltered life. I was in a wheelchair when I was 12, you know, and we were so naive at that age, and not like the sophistication the kids are these days.
So you got your wings, and then you're posted back to England.
Yeah.
And then presumably it's time, that magic moment where you crew up, is it?
Yeah. Well, when we came back on the Queen Elizabeth from New York with 17,000 others on board. Two people fell overboard and the boat didn't stop. We weren't in convoy, so just threw a couple of lifebelts over. And then we got back into Gourock up in the Clyde. And then we went down to get a little bit of rehabilitation at Oxford. And then we were sent to... That's when we went to the OTU, the Operational Training Unit. And there you started to learn about operational flying. And of course you had to have a crew. And the crew of Wellington, there were five in the crew, pilot, navigator, wireless operator, radio operator, and a gunner, navigator, and a gunner. And What they did was you weren't given a crew, you just assembled a crew. Just imagine a room like this, and the navigators were put in, all the pilots were put in, all the crew members were put in, and they said, "Right, sort yourself out into crews." And he said, "Would you like to fly with me? I need a navigator." And it really was like that. And you had no idea of the background and the ability of anybody.
But it sort of worked, didn't it?
It worked, yes. I only knew of every one instance where it didn't. And that was a crew who I knew met at Operational Training later on, whose crew refused to fly with the pilot because the pilot had in five flights, he had five crash landings. So the crew refused to fly with him. But they were threatened with LMF, lack of moral fibre, but they said, no, we're not refusing to fly, we're just refusing to fly with him. So that's the only instance I ever knew of it not working. But I was very, very lucky indeed.
So who were you, your crew?
Quite a mixed. My bomber, but starting at the front, my bomber up front, he was a very dapper little man. He started life in a gypsy caravan around Manchester area. His mum had a glass ball, and he used to come on operations with a crease in his trousers, you know. He now lives in the tax haven in Andorra, having made a fortune. Marvellous little man, very good friend. My engineer, sadly, my first engineer, Les, on our first operation, we had to abort because he just sit on the floor and shiver and shake, couldn't do anything. And we lost instruments and we had to abort the trip. I think, in retrospect, I think we possibly could have carried on, but through inexperience, we came back. Normally, when you went on a squadron, you did what are called a second dicky trip with an experienced pilot. Well, this was just at the start of the Battle of Berlin. It was a maximum effort, so it didn't do any of that. They said, right, there's your airplane, there's your special duty board, off you go. So that was in November 43. And I think the lack of experience, we aborted that trip and came back. But on our next trip...
So he left the crew, did he?
A couple of trips later, he just couldn't cope. And then a couple of trips later, we had engines on fire, and he couldn't cope at all, couldn't help with anything in the aircraft. And the extinguisher buttons, the grounder buttons on the Lancaster are down there somewhere, and I had to half get out of the seat to press the buttons. And when I got back, I reported it to the station commander, Wing Commander Ford Kelsey, and he left the squadron that afternoon, so he wouldn't mess with others and create a bit of misery with the other crews. So he just disappeared. So what happened to him, I don't know. Normally in those situations, people were made LMF, lacking moral fibre, LMF, which is, he should never have been, because he never refused to fly. He just couldn't cope when he was flying. And there was an awful lot of air crew like that in Bomber Command. And they were the bravest of the brave, knowing full well that they were scared to death when they were going flying, but they continued to fly. And that was quite something. So there we are, we're on the squadron, and then they said, right, off you go. And we were given a special duty of squadron.
Do you know why you were sent to 101 Special Duties?
I did find out, yes, because in heavy conversion unit, when you are converting, because of the lack of...
This is when you're moving up to a four-engine
We went to heavy conversion unit, where we started to learn to fly on the Halifax, and these were all aircraft that had been withdrawn from service and unfit for service flying, and they were clapped out, poor old things. And having done a few hours on those and got those all sorted out, they went on the same station to LFS, Lancaster Finishing School. There you started flying Lancasters. Again, aircraft which had been withdrawn from service as unfit for operational flying, and they weren't very good. The casualty rate in learning to fly in Bomber Command was 25%. So, and then you started to realise, it's getting a bit serious. And there... again, my little problem converting onto Lancaster, wonderful aeroplane. When you've got four engines, 1,280 horsepower each, with all the props on takeoff going around at 3,000 revs, you've got tremendous torque, it made you swing. And with my little short legs, I couldn't keep these bloody things straight down the runway. So I was a little bit later converting on there. And my friend Paul, who had trained with quite many, many years, he was posted at 101 Squadron. And when my turn came a couple of days later, I said to the squadron commander, can I follow Paul onto 101 Squadron? And he said, it's a special duty squadron. We only send the best ones there. I said, oh, thank you very much. So anyway, a couple of days later, he said, right, Warman, 101 Squadron, off you go. And I said, oh, change of heart. He said, no. He said, it's a squadron with the highest attrition rate in the service, and they have the first call on the availability of aircrew. So I went to 101 squadron.
Oh, gosh.
What were you thinking
when you heard that?
Well, it came very, 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 very soon, because the day I arrived on the squadron, my friend Paul had been shot down and killed the night before. So you suddenly realised it's serious. You know, people shoot at you, you know, and it's not fair.
So all the time you were training, you just didn't give all that much thought?
In operational training, you did fighter filler exercise. You knew you were going to be attacked by fighters, and you learned how to evade from them. But it didn't seem real. Didn't seem real. It wasn't until you started flying that you did find out very, very quickly that it was serious stuff. And I was very, very lucky with my crew. The first operation I went on was just at the beginning of the Battle of Berlin, and my first raid, successful raid, was to Berlin in November.
The first raid was Berlin?
Berlin, first raid, yeah.
That's quite a debut, isn't it?
It was, you learned very quickly. Yes, and there we were given what they called an SDO, a special duty operators. 101 Squadron was a special duty squadron, and we were flying a very, at the time, very, very secret radio countermeasure called ABC, Airborne Cigar. And it was a system on the aircraft whereby you had these three big, huge aerials, transmitter aerials, and a little receiver one. And our special duty operator had a set at the back of the aircraft. They took the rest bed out. It had a rest bed in the back of the aircraft. So they took the rest bed out, which was rather a shame because we couldn't get the wafts on the back. He sat there, with his little set, completely in the dark. He didn't see out anything at all. He just had his little 3-inch cathode ray tube. And he could tune into the German night fighter controller's information to the night fighters. And he got a blip on his screen, covered up with the aircraft screen, decided it was German speaking because there was Poles and Czechs, and then he blasted engine noise, switched another switch, and that blasted engine noise out on the air, and that jammed the instructions to the German night fighters. And this was very, very successful. Saved a lot of aircraft being shot down. This only sad thing was, with our transmissions, we were using the German frequencies, so the German night fighters knew the frequencies we were using, so they could home on us. And because we were used on every bombing raid that went out, we were staggered supposedly every 90 seconds right throughout the bomber stream. So we were covering a bomber stream, and that added to our attrition.
Rusty, you were saying that your first mission was to Berlin.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got flak when... I mean, first of all, you've got to take off. And
yeah.
And I know the Lancaster was a wonderful plane, but it's quite a big ask to just take off, isn't it, with a bomb load. Then you've got to deal with Dutch coast flak.
Yeah.
Then there's other flak. You've got, by 1943, you've got 10,000 anti-aircraft guns, at least, in Germany.
Yeah.
Berlin is about the most heavily defended city on the planet.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you sort of take all that in on your first flight? I mean,
again, as I say, we were terribly naive. From our little experience on our abortive trip, we realised that it wasn't going to be easy. Well, it wasn't difficult, it was easy, but when you got into trouble, it was difficult. In our very first raid, all our operations were at night, we're day flying in the dark, so we're taking off in the dark, and getting the aircraft off the ground with a heavy load on, although our equipment and an extra crew member was an extra 1,000 pounds weight, they didn't reduce our bomb load. We still had a full bomb load, 20,000 pounds, and getting it off the ground wasn't a struggle, but it was difficult.
I mean, you must sort of, you know, you're taking off. You can see presumably the flare path of the runway, and you must know that it's sort of.
The hedge,
it's going to run out.
The hedge at the end appeared very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And you very, very rarely you miss. So you took off very, very slowly. And more often than not, you're taking off straight into cloud. And you're straight into cloud about a couple of hundred feet. And there, the concentration was such that you had to believe your flying instruments. You couldn't fly by the seat of your pants. You had to rely on instruments. The concentration then was very, very strict.
And you know, it's nighttime, there's thick cloud, and there's lots of other Lancasters about. Mm. I mean, I know the sky's a big place, but it must have been quite easy to crash into someone else, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. We did that. So there we are. Well, of course, then we off. You usually had an assembly point somewhere, where a rendezvous point nearly over the North Sea.
And that would be above the cloud?
If it was clear,
yeah.
But otherwise you're still in clouds. So you could be flying in a cloud. You had what a system called G, which was a very accurate navigation system where you could plot your position within a few miles. So that was quite handy. But once you got past 3 degrees east, that you lost that. So then it was just direct DR navigation, direct navigation. So from there on, you went off on your route. The route to the target wasn't just straight there and straight back. They did dog legs all over the place sometimes.
And that was to dodge flak, known
dog fighter areas and known areas. But on our first raid, we crossed the Dutch coast, and we only just touched the coast, Dutch coast, and we have 5 fighter attacks, one straight after the other, by GU-88 and Focke-Wulf 190. And to do that, the evasion of action, you flew in a corkscrew pattern, whereby the gunners were brilliant. If it hadn't been for my gunners, we would have been dead years ago. They'd say, you know, flying along, they attacked by fighters, and they say, dive starboard, go. And, you know, if you said why, it was too late. So then you dived starboard, you dived starboard, and you flew in a corkscrew pattern, and you flew like that. And that was the heavy bomber. That was jolly hard work. And we had these 5 fighter attacks, one after the other, and we were doing that for nearly half an hour. Mm. And you're pretty well knackered by the time. And that's
before you've even reached the first target.
Yeah, that's right, yes. And then after that, you had to carry on. And there were no end of defence areas where the Germans had fighter beacons where they assembled their fighters. But the German radar was brilliant. They were far in advance of ours. With their Würzburg and Freya radar, they knew when we were taking off, they knew an operation was taking place, they knew the height we were flying, they knew the speed we were flying, they knew the direction we were flying, but they didn't know where we were going. But they knew had this all the information. So they could direct their fighters into it. And they had wonderful schemes. They had what they called a Wildesau and Samsau, which is wild boar and tame boar. With their radar, with their wild boar aircraft, they knew the bomber stream was going along, and they could direct their single engine ME-109s outside, or the Focke-Wulf 190 into the bomber stream. Then the fighter could find a bomber to fight on his own. And then the tame boar, with their Würzburg radar, they could direct a German fighter, onto an aircraft. And with their Liechtenstein radar on the front, the Germans could home onto us. And that was very, very accurate and very, very good.
Rusty, I mean, you were saying that you know, how naive you were when you... Yeah. First, you know, that night that you took off on your first raid, but you must have grown up pretty quickly, didn't you?
You did.
You know, a big raid like that to Berlin, you get back from that. What, I mean, the next few raids, I mean, are you starting to kind of learn very quickly, tricks of the trade?
You did. You weren't told anything, you just learned, you picked it up for yourself. But the comradeship on the squadrons was such, and the life that we led on the squadron was such that it was much more relaxed than the normal service life.
I mean, could we just sort of go through, I think it would be interesting for people to kind of understand what a sort of day in the life of a bomber squadron would be. I mean, what time would you be getting up in the morning?
Well, normally, if you'd been flying the night before, you usually had 8 hours rest. You were allowed 8 hours rest. But normally, if you weren't flying the night before, you used to have what are called a moon period. You never flew when you had a full moon, so because it was like flying in daylight. So we had about 4 or 5 days where we had daytime off. And the waking up in the morning in after those sort of days.
Were you in a hut or were you in a building? Or?
Yeah, well, Letford Magna was built by Wimpy's in 90 days at the cost of £800,000. And it was literally, we're living in Nissen huts. Have you got a Nissen hut here? I don't know.
Not here, no.
Just a corrugated iron Nissen hut with beds inside. Corrugated iron inside, a pot stove in the middle of the room, and that's the only heating you had. And my little wireless operator, he's quite a wag. We used to pinch each other's coal and steal each other's furniture and burn them on the stove to get a bit of warmth. And little Taffy.
So the whole crew, all seven of you, were in this.
All seven of us, eight of us, seven. Yeah. The special duty operator wasn't allowed to billet with us. They all had to billet separately.
And you were a sergeant pilot at this?
I was a sergeant pilot, yeah. They were billeted separately because if they spoke in their sleep, they could give secrets away. So they were separate. But we had these little Nissen huts, and Taffy used to push his bed up against the stove. And in the morning when he woke up, he used to spit at it. And if it sizzled, he got up, and if it didn't sizzle, he stayed in bed. So you weren't great. There wasn't any great panic at breakfast time.
Right.
But in the morning, you went up to the flight office in the flight crew room, and there you'd see a battle order, and on the wall there'd be a battle order.
And which flight were you in?
Pardon?
Which flight were you in?
I was in C flight, ABC's flight. I was in C flight. Wing Commander Robinson, to start with. And there we are. You saw the battle order. All the battle order told you was that A, you were flying, the aircraft you were flying in, the crew you had, and the time of briefing. And that's it. Didn't know any idea where you were going. No idea at all. But if you knew you were flying, you had to go out and check your aircraft. So we went out and made sure the aircraft was all right, perhaps did a little air test, mm-hmm. make sure it was okay.
Might actually take off and fly.
Pardon?
You might actually take off and fly.
Yeah. But then you talk to the ground crew, and my ground crew were brilliant, lovely. Kept in touch with them for many, many years. And you'd ask the ground crew, what's the petrol load and what's the fuel load? And if you had lots of petrol and not so many bombs, you knew you were going on a long trip, vice versa. Not so much petrol, lots of bombs, you weren't going very far. That you had an idea of what sort of raid you were going on. And you didn't know anything about it until you got into the main briefing. The special duty operator, the navigator, had a little separate meeting. Then we had a main briefing where all the crew were there. And then at the
all
end...
All seven of you would go to the main briefing? All seven of you?
All seven of us.
Yeah.
All eight of us used to go to the main briefing. And at the end of the room, something like this, we're all sitting down. And at the end, a big chart at the end with the map of Europe with a curtain over. And then they pulled the curtain back and there was a red line, a cotton... tape red line going to the target and back again. So then you knew what the target was. And if it was a long one, you get moans and groans. And this sort of. So then you knew what the target was. And then every section leader, the nav leader, the pilot, the intelligence officer, the padre, the station commander, gunnery leader, armoured leader, all gave a little briefing, tell you what to expect on the raid. And the people who we had the greatest sympathy for, we learned, was the Met Man, because they had to give you what the weather was going to be like. In those days, there's no satellites, nothing like that. There were six weather ships across the Atlantic and a few weather stations in the UK, and that was it. And they had aircraft used to fly out over Europe, weather report aircraft. But it wasn't terribly accurate. So the weather, poor old Met Man ends up hiding to nothing about what he was guessing at. But there we are, we beefed. And then, of course, you had to get out your aircraft. So we went down to the crew room, collected our parachute, got our kit, and went in and got dressed and waited in the crew room for the transport. Just tell them about the Long John.
Yeah.
Well, as a pilot, all the kit you had was a woolly jumper, gentleman down there wearing a woolly jumper, very similar to that, with a scarf, long john underwear, and fur-lined boots. And that's a battle dress, and that's basically what a pilot wore. That was fine. But in the long johns, you were given two pairs, one to wear and one to wash. Well, after a couple of trips, after two or three trips, I'd worn these long johns, and I thought, if I change, though, I'll change my look. So I wore the same pair of long johns for 30 operations, nearly 200 hours. And the Navig used to say, when you take them off, you stood them up in your locker. And this is one thing.
But it obviously worked.
It worked, yes. Yeah. Well, this is one thing you hear. You hear about all the aircraft, you get the noise, you get the experience. But one thing you can't get is the smell. The smell is quite characteristic. And when you've got eight bods with 8 hours, 10 hours flying, sweating and whatever, it wasn't exactly wholesome.
But I mean, you know, I've been lucky enough to be inside a Lancaster. I mean, it seemed unbelievably like a tin can because, you know, when you look at a Lancaster parked up on the, you know, taxied up on the runway, it looks absolutely enormous, 102 foot wide wingspan and all the rest of those four Merlin engines. Yeah. But when you get inside, it's really a tin can. You've got to grapple over two wing spars and
we never thought of that. It's amazing.
I was completely stunned by how simple and spare it was. I mean, the creature comforts were very, very thin on the ground, if at all.
Yeah, well, the only comfort we had was an L-stand at the back of the aircraft, but the temperatures are minus 30, minus 40. It's the last thing you wanted to do is go and use the loo. So that was very, very rarely used.
But
so
you'd have some, I mean, you had some, I mean, like everyone who survived, you don't survive 30 and 50 operations and 50 tours without having some close escapes.
Well, it's quite strange. The aircraft really became one of your crew. You just treated it like another member of the crew. And you just accepted it for what it was. And it was a wonderful aeroplane, as we found out, which is really remarkable.
But you were on that Nuremberg raid, and there was an occasion where another plane crashed into you. I mean, tell me about that.
No, well, that was at Hasselt in Belgium, where we had the mid-air collision. We had what they called a transport plan, whereby we were flying, weren't attacking main cities, we were flying targets, railway marshalling yard, troop concentrations, railway depots, to stop the invasion stuff getting down the invasion beaches. And this was going to Hasselt on the Belgian-German border. And we were about 10 minutes from the target, and we had a mid-air collision, the other aircraft crashed into the side of us. He slipped underneath us.
Did he just not see you?
No. I didn't see him, the crew saw him. Curly, the engineer, was standing at his window looking out, and he was in the dark, in the cloud, and all he said it was a very rude word, something about fornicating in Hades, I think it was. And and this aircraft just crashed into us and slid underneath us. His propellers cut through our engine nacelles.
Cut through?
Our engine nacelles and cut through the bomb air's compartment just behind his feet. His canopy was torn off, so you can imagine what happened to the other aircraft. His mid-upper turret.
But the bomb aimer was all right.
The bomb aimer was all right. Just behind his feet, it's about 6 inches behind his feet. And his bit of a turret, the bit that sticks up on the top, cut through our fuselage just at the back of the bombers and cut a big hole right across the aircraft. We lost part of the tail, we lost our electrics. But our engines being slightly in front, our engines were okay.
Was it still flying or okay, just?
Well, it's quite amazing. We sat on top of the other aircraft, and while we were there, the controls went completely limp. There's nothing. And that was could have only matter of seconds, but it was completely limp. That was quite frightening. And afterwards, I was asked to write a report.
So there was a point where you were sort of jarred together and then came on sort of unstuck.
He fell away. Apparently, I didn't see it, but the crew saw it. He broke up and fell away. He was broken up. And his mid-upper turret was carved off. His fuselage was broken. His mid-upper turret, his canopy over the front where the pilot and engineer was gone. And they were all killed. We found out subsequently that they were all killed.
But you were able to keep flying.
We were able to keep flying because our engines were in front. And we were about 10 minutes from the target. And we still had our bombs on board. So we decided, well, we're only 10 minutes, we'll go and bomb. But we went off.
You were so lucky that they didn't detonate your bombs.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Again, it's 99% luck. You know, it's amazing. So anyway, we went on, and we didn't hear the instructions from the master bomber saying, don't go in and bomb. So we went on our own, and we hit the marshalling yards, albeit 4.5 miles north of the target. But anyway, we got back with the great help of the crew, And my rear gunner, we knew there was massive damage at the back of the aircraft, and had we to take evasive action, we could well have broken up because our two main longerons were cracked.
But it must have been really nerve-wracking coming into land, wasn't it? Knowing that you had all this damage and not knowing precisely how much damage had been caused.
No. When we got back, I gave the crew the chance. I said, we're back over base. I gave them a chance to bail out, and they wouldn't. They said, no, we're going to stop with you. And this is, again, my rear gunner, when we had mid-air collision, he'd been knocked unconscious. But he only very temporary came back conscious again. And when we were coming back, I said, get your parachute, Harry, come up front, just in case we break up. He said, no, I've got to stop here and look after you. And this is the rear gunner's attitude. It really was wonderful. But when I got back, I had to write a report about it.
How was the landing, first of all?
Oh, the landing. We did it. Well, we had to do a crash landing.
just glide over that
bit. And with one wheel gone, we skidded across.
So what did you do, land on one wheel?
One wheel, yeah. We landed on one wheel. We skidded across the grass towards the control tower. Sadly, there wasn't a casualty that night. This was in the semi-dark, and all the WAFs and the control staff came out on the balcony to see this idiot bend his aeroplane, and one of the WAFs jumped back and sprained her ankle. And that was the...
And can you remember what number that was?
That was about my 25th operation. So then we had the Nuremberg and Berlin afterwards.
I mean, what do you think was your toughest raid, or was there not
the,
one
the,
that was
the raid that affected us most, apart from this and the fact that we barrel rolled to Lancaster, blowed upside down, this sort of thing, was the Nuremberg raid, and we were very, very lucky, again, because of the attitude of the gunners and the diligence of the gunners. We stayed safe. It was a raid which should never have taken place. It was basically a long straight leg of 265 miles across Germany, south of the Ruhr. Two German night fighter, because Eider and Otto, where the Germans had sent 240 fighters down to look after their beacons, and we just flew into these fighters, and it was mayhem. We'd only just crossed the German border, and we counted 16 going down, and we were seeing aircraft blowing up and just falling out of the sky.
And these are all, you know, some of them are going to be people you know, presumably.
Oh, yes, yeah. It was really amazing. Another little naughty story, if I may.
Yeah.
One of our pilots, a chap called... tanker. He was flying on this raid, and he had to take a senior officer, a very religious senior officer, with him on this raid. And he got it mixed up in all these fighters. And his rear gunner called up, and he said, "Skipper." He said, "There's fighters about everywhere." He said, "The bastards are everywhere." And this rear, very religious voice came from the front of the aircraft. He said, "Never fear, rear gunner, never fear, the good Lord is with us." And the rear gunner's come out, and he said, "It might be up your bloody end, there's no sign of him back here." And this is a true story, because the skipper told me that after briefing. But normally on a raid, it's about, as I was saying, about 60% normal flying, and about 25% panic. Well, on this raid, because of the fighter activity, it was about 80%, 90% panic all the way. And when we got back, we were so stressed and so wound, we just like zombies. And when we got back, we told the intelligence debriefing officer what it was, and he didn't believe the fact. On this long leg, with the wind, all the winds were wrong and all the weather was wrong, they took about 90 minutes, 60 minutes to fly along this leg, and there were 90 aircraft shot down there. So one aircraft a minute on that long leg was going down.
And oh, that's horrendous.
There were about 27 on the leg coming home. And all in all, there's over 100 odd aircraft, 130, 140 aircraft lost that night. 96, 95 were lost over Germany. But it was really, when we got back, the place was like a zombie. We didn't operate for about a fortnight after that.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, yeah. But when we got down to the mess for our post-operational meal, all the girls, all the WAFs had disappeared. And they'd left our meals out with a note saying, help yourself. And they were in the restroom crying their eyes out and bemoaning the fact that they'd lost friends and sweethearts and this sort of thing. So, and the WAF officer said, now, all sit at the one table. Don't leave any empty spaces at the table. Because we sent 26 aircraft that night and we lost seven. And that's over a quarter of the squadron that night disappeared. 280, 220. You talk about 26 aircraft, that's 210 airmen. And we lost 60 last night. Just imagine a room like this. The casualties in Bomber Command were such that out of 100 aircrew, just imagine you're 100 aircrew, out of that 100 aircrew, 51 were killed and didn't come. So all you lot have gone. You wouldn't be going home. And of the rest, 12 were bailed out, eight escaped. One managed to get back home. One managed to get back home. And of the rest, only 24 were left. So only about 24 of you were left to go home. And of that 24, nearly all had some physical or mental disability. I'm all right now.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.